Well, let's before we move into The Handmaid's Tale, let's go back a little bit. I was looking at some of the publicity material that Houghton Mifflin had sent, and it was kind of interesting to me about this one article about you, which goes back to your background. You were the daughter of an entomologist. Is that correct?
That's right.
So you grew up in an educated household.
I grew up in an educated household, pretty far from all other households. In other words, I did grow up during a major part of my childhood in the Canadian North Bush, way, way out in the sticks. And I'm not talking a community of people here. I'm talking about a cabin in the woods. Because what my father did up there was run a research station on forest insects, bugs that eat trees. And in order to do that, he had to spend a large part of every year collecting them on location.
What was it like growing up in that isolated area?
Well, one result was that I entered society with absolutely none of those structures in place that kids pick up from their surround about who's good and who's bad. I just didn't have any of that. No racial stereotypes, no rich people and poor people. I realize now that we were probably quite poor at the time, but it didn't occur to me because there weren't any measuring sticks around. So when I entered civilized life, if you can call it that, I had none of those little things in place, and a lot of it came as total news to me. And I think I've been in a state of semi-culture shock ever since. Or let us say that I'm in the position of an anthropologist within my own society.
And yet you caught up to a degree with the realities of discrimination and whatever in your book of poetry, the journals of Susanna Moody. This is a family that goes into the wilderness, in effect, and is not well treated. Isn't that correct?
But Susanna Moody was a 19th century English gentlewoman who emigrated to Canada in 1832. She's my reverse. For her, the bush was a strange and alien place. For me, it was home. For her, civilization was normal. For me, it was peculiar. My book, The Journals of Susanna Moody, is based on a real person, as I've just indicated.
You did, however, get into the big city on occasion, didn't you?
Oh, yes. December, January, and February.
Just to warm up a little bit.
To warm up. Well, when it froze over, I guess that was sometimes as early as November, we left, and we went into the bush again when it melted, and that would be April.
What kind of education did you have living in this isolated area?
Well, mixed. When I was old enough, I went to school in the winter, which means that I've always connected school with gray, snow, cold, etc.
Most of us do.
The worst thing about that
was... Some of us connect education with sleep.
No, I didn't find that. The rest of the time, up in the woods, my mother, who had been a school teacher, would take the school curriculum up with us, and my brother and myself would study under her direction, and we would get through the part of the curriculum we were supposed to do, except we could usually do it in about 2 hours a day, and the rest of the time we could play. So it just took a lot longer in school to do what we could do on our own faster. And I guess that leads to self-directed work, which is what I do.
Were there a lot of books in your cabin?
There weren't piles of books, but there were enough. And my mother was a reading mother. That is, she read to the children out loud. And that's one of the things I remember quite clearly from my childhood, was being read to. And that means that I became a reading mother myself when I became a mother. We always had bedtime story. I set great store by it.
What happened when you got out of high school?
Went to university.
Where?
I was intending to, because I already wanted to be a writer, I was intending to become a journalist.
You were?
I was, yes. But I went to...
That's
my...
not writing, though.
Well, I thought it was. You see, I was young.
A lot of us make that mistake when we go into journalism.
I was 17. I was saved from that fate by sexism. I went to my cousin, who was a journalist, second cousin, and said, you know, should I go into this? And he said, this was the 50s, remember, he said, well, to be honest with you, he said, women who work for newspapers only are assigned two things, the fashion page, the ladies' page, and the obituaries. So, although some people would say that essentially that's what I'm writing today, I decided not to go into it.
That's a situation that no longer prevails, though.
No, not, but you see, those were my formative years, and so I got formed not as a journalist. I went into English language and literature instead.
Now, where did you study?
I studied as an undergraduate in Toronto, University of Toronto, and as a graduate student, I studied at Harvard. Which was Radcliffe the first year, and then it became Harvard for three other years.
Did you have any degree of cultural shock going across the border and studying in Cambridge?
Well, of course, it was the land of my ancestors. Who were those Puritans that came in 1625, 1635? I was part of the second big wave. So it was very interesting to me from that point of view. I went to Salem and read the genealogical library there and went and looked at dark, gloomy old houses and pictures of people in corsets and black dresses. So that was my contact with my roots. And the culture shock, I think, it was definitely there, and I think it was more of a shock than it would have been if I'd gone to Texas, for instance, which is so noticeably different from Canada. But my family was from Nova Scotia. And going back to the New England coast, it was similar enough that you kept wondering, if it was so similar, why was it different? And there were little groups of Canadians who used to congregate in bars and discuss this subject, and they would be hard-pressed, and they would come up with things like, well, their mailboxes are a different color, or their subways have more graffiti and they're dirtier, things like that, because Canadians at that time had no fix on their own identity, so they were groping around for it. And I found that very interesting, and my study of American colonial history and literature was also very illuminating, because the period 1780 to 1830 in the States was very similar to 50 to 70 in Canada. A lot of the same movements going on.
Americans also had no fixed identity about Canada, and in fact, I think have over the years, at least until more recently, have felt that Canada was back porch. I've gone to Canada a couple of times, and I have felt integrated and as though I'm indeed in the United States. It's part of America. I don't know if that's good or bad, and it's good in some respects, bad in another, I guess, if you as a Canadian feel that Canada should have more of a cultural identity.
Well, let's just question a few of your statements here.
Okay. What's been known to happen?
Yes. It's very easy to feel what you felt if you're only there for a short time and engaged with it on a very superficial level. But you would be interested to know that some of the Vietnam escapees who went to different countries had the most culture shock in Canada. It was worse than in Sweden or England or other European countries because they thought it would be the same. Or they thought it would be the States 20 years ago, you know, those kinds of things. And then when they started realizing that there were these peculiar differences, it was more of a shock to them than if they had gone to Sweden knowing that everybody there was going to be Swedish. And some of them felt, you know, betrayed, confused. Some of them stayed, and among those people are some of the most ardent Canadian nationalists you would ever hope to meet. Some of the people who are most keen on Canadian cultural identity these days are people who started life as Americans. I suppose it's the old convert theory. But I would not myself sort of fall into assumptions about Canada being the same. Don't know whether you read Andrew Malcolm's book, writes for the New York Times and published a book last year about Canada, which I reviewed. He was there for several years, and he got fairly heavily into it. And I don't think he would support your assumption.
These Vietnam defectors, you call them escapees, but they were not escapees, they were defectors. How did the Canadians view them? With any degree of contempt? Is that what caused some of the cultural difficulties?
No, not at all. Canada has always been the place where people escape to. When things are going on in the States that they don't get on with. Canada was the top end of the Underground Railroad, as you know, before the Civil War. And it was also where the Vietnam War escapees went.
I'm going to use that word.
You can use defectors. I'll use escapees. It's part of our cultural difference. No, there were some Canadians who were really quite friendly towards them. Canadians don't have any difficulty at all with individual Americans. They just don't, and Americans don't have difficulty with individual Canadians.
Unless they happen to be French and English, and
then there seems to be some gulf in Quebec,
isn't that
true?
May
be some, as there is between Americans and people who speak other languages. Language is an integrating factor sometimes. But when it comes to foreign policy, there are often differences of opinion. So the Americans who came to Canada didn't find, you know, Canadians spitting at them in the streets or, you know, kicking them off their lawn or much. I think it did happen occasionally, but not usually. Usually they were quite friendly, which is why a number of them have stayed.
Well, we get off the track a little bit. Let's go back to Harvard and Radcliffe. And tell me what happened to you when you graduated.
When I graduated? Well, let's see what happened to me. I went there for 2 years. Then I took 2 years off to write a novel, which I did. In fact,
about the Edible Woman?
Yeah, two novels. One didn't get published.
Tell me about the Edible Woman while we're in this phase of your life. How did that novel originate? And
I think it originated because I saw a Mickey Mouse cake in a Kresge's window. And it occurred to me that people make a lot of anthropomorphic pieces of food, which they then eat. Don't you find that peculiar? They make food in the shapes of things, and they often make food in the shapes of people, and then they eat them.
I know. There's an erotic bakery shop near my house.
That's recent.
It's a chain of erotic bakeries. Have you seen them in
No, area? No. That's since my day.
They have any shape of any phallic bakery item you would want, or any...
Well, I find that vaguely cannibalistic, and I did at the time, but I was about on the level of the gingerbread man and all of that, which is about how far confectionery had gotten that day. So I think I started from one of those kinds of metaphors, and little sugar brides and grooms on the tops of wedding cakes and things like that. And I worked for a market research company during one of those years, so I had lots of material. And people were very, very concerned about consumption, both in that era and at that company, as you might expect. And it was way, way before anorexia got to be chic. In fact, I didn't know there was such a thing. I sure do now because everybody and their granny has written me about it because of the Edible Woman, but I was just making it all up. No, I've never had an eating problem.
Did you go back to Canada when you were writing that book?
Yes, I did. Couldn't get a job in the States. You know that. One has to apply to do such a thing.
Is that that has to do with what visa?
Yeah, it has to do with not letting in foreigners who can take jobs that Americans could take. And I was at such a lowly level, of course, that about the only kind of job I could get would be some sort of flunky, and there were lots of those around here to do that.
I wasn't aware of the job restrictions, especially from people who live in Canada.
I know, but they're there. I once got stopped at the border because I was coming to the States to give a poetry reading. And the guy said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Cornell. And he said, what for? I said, I'm going to give a poetry reading of my own work. He said, are you being paid for it? I said, yes. He said, you can't go in. So as far as we're concerned, you're the same as a violin player. He said, get somebody else to read your poetry. So we had to phone Cornell, and they had to say that, in fact, I was the only person who could do this thing. And then they let me in.
But you're lecturing currently. You haven't had any recent problems.
No, because
problems,
I
have
a nice big visa, several pages long.
So there are ways of getting around these restrictions.
You can apply for it, and they can let you in. But you can't just walk in and get a job, nor should you be able to. You know, I'm not against this. I think every country should be able to control who can come in and get a job. It's just one of the things that countries do.
Does Canada have the same restrictions?
You have to have landed immigrant status and what have you and this and that, sure.
So you went back to Canada after not being able to find employment here or get employment here.
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't try, but I knew about it because I'd had to go through this procedure to invigilate exams at Harvard. Anyway, I went back there for 2 years. I wrote my two novels. Then I came back to Harvard to finish my PhD requirements, which I did. And that was the end of my residency. I didn't have to be there in person anymore. Then I got a job at Sir George Williams in Montreal.
What is Sir George Williams?
It's a university.
Where? In Montreal?
Yes, Montreal. Uh-huh. And then I got one in Alberta. And I was writing my thesis at that time. And then The Edible Woman got published, and somebody optioned it for movies. And then I had enough money not to have to continue writing my thesis anymore, so I stopped.
You were sprinkling your life with poetry through this period.
I was, yes. Poetry was one of the things that I could write at graduate school and still carry the courses. Novels I had to take time off for.
I understand you somehow found yourself in Iran.
How did that happen? Well, I was going around the world one time. This is later in my life when we were traveling quite a lot. And we had, in fact, an 18-month-old baby, which is great for countries like Iran because it's a terrific passport. People are nicer to you when you have a little baby. Even Iranian and Afghani men who aren't too keen on numbers of other things, but they do like babies. So, and they're also handy when you're going through customs because if they scream and yell, you get shot through like a bullet.
It's bad phraseology to use when you're referring to Iran.
Yes, it is. Well, I was there just before the Shah was overthrown, and I was in Afghanistan 6 weeks before the Daoud regime toppled. Needless to say, I had no idea that either of these things was going to happen or I wouldn't have gone. But I was going around the world on my way to Australia. And you can get a ticket that allows you to touch down anywhere you like, as long as you don't go backwards.
Well, why did you stay so long in Iran? I understand you stayed 6 weeks?
No.
6 months?
No.
6 days?
More like it. No, I was passing through.
Just passing through.
Oh, yeah. We were passing through because
misread something in Marley's material here.
Yeah, he must have. The whole trip took 6 weeks, but I wasn't 6 weeks in Iran, nor would I have wished to be. I did drop in on Kenneth Taylor, who was kind enough to give us a car. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to get anywhere because the traffic was so horrible. And we said, how do you like your new posting? He said, oh, it's all right, he said, except there's not much going on.
That's a little dull over there. There was an interesting broadcast on 60 Minutes last night with Diane Sawyer,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if you happen to see it.
It was described to me.
And the women, I don't know if it was the case when you were in Iran.
Yes, it was.
But she was required to wear the headdress.
Yeah. It wasn't as much the case in Iran, but it was totally the case in Afghanistan, which is much more puritanical even than Iran on that subject. And in Afghanistan at that time, they wore a garment called the chador, which has a little cap on the top and goes down to your ankles and has a little netted window for your eyes to look through. And that is what Muslim women wear on the street. Underneath it, you would see these little Western shoes going along.
Well, no doubt you drew on your brief visit to Afghanistan and Iran as well as your own Puritan roots in forming the ideology that is the foundation for The Handmaid's Tale. Are you religious?
I am religious, but not in a sectarian sense.
Do you see a threat from organized religion that could lead to the kind of 1984, Brave New World society depicted in The Handmaid's Tale.
Okay, well, let's just make a couple of distinctions here.
Okay.
From organized religion as it exists today denominationally, no. In fact, some of those people, and I would cite, for instance, the Quakers and the Unitarians, certain branches of the Catholic Church and the United Church of Canada and so forth, the Anglicans, they're very keen on human rights. And with, if you look at, you know, who's doing what in Latin America, a lot of those people are missionaries. So let's get that one straight. However, if you come at it a different way and you say, if you were going for power, if you were going for the big brass ring in the United States and you wanted to put in a fairly totalitarian regime, what slogan would you run it under? Now, that's a different kind of question. It has nothing to do with people's inner religious convictions, and I'll point out to you that the Lord's Prayer is in The Handmaid's Tale on page 113 in a somewhat different version, but verse for verse, that's what it is. If you were going to try for some kind of totalitarian regime in the States, what flag would you fly for it? Well, you wouldn't say, "Hi, fellows, we're communists, and we'd like to form your new government," because nobody would go for it.
I tried that.
Even if you put it in,
yeah.
Even if you put it in and by staging a sort of coup, it would not have nearly enough support on the ground to be able to stay there for 2 minutes, my feeling. If you said, "Hi, folks, we're liberal Democrats, and we're going to put in a repressive regime to make sure that all of you are liberal Democrats, too," the thing would be such a contradiction in terms that nobody would buy it. You know, a repressive regime to implement repressive freedom of speech. I mean, it just doesn't. The two things don't go together. If, however, in this day and age, it's 1986, you were to say, "We want you all to obey the will of God, which we have a direct pipeline to. You know, we have the word, and the word is the word that we have, and now you're all going to do it." That would probably get a few more followers, at least initially. In fact, who is about to run for president, do you think? Last I heard, there
was,
yes, they're thinking of running Pat Robertson, the television evangelist. So I would say that if you wanted to...
Does this frighten you?
Does it frighten me?
Mm-hmm.
So many things are frightening that I would say it's among the things. Now, there are good things in my book. The world hasn't blown up in it. And there's a sort of standoff between the States and Russia. So that's positive, isn't it?
George Bush, of course, has been courting the right wing and the moral majority. But it seems to me that the religious fanatics, and I would assume I can describe the moral majority as a group of very close to being religious fanatics, they have never been able to make major inroads in terms of politics in this country. And I just wonder...
Of course, my folks in my book don't do it by the vote. They do it by a coup. And
yes.
In order to stage a coup like that, you would, of course, have to infiltrate several things, including the security system of Congress and some of the other systems that are in place, including the army.
But coups don't work unless there is the support of the people. Because coups... are replaced as a result of other coups.
This is true.
The banana republics in Latin America are case in point. I mean, one topples and another one comes in and
yeah,
it topples. And
sometimes it's not entirely just the support of the people, though, and sometimes it's certainly not the support of all the people. You can do it with a minority of the people if those people are well organized and the other people aren't, as you know perfectly well.
The Handmaid's Tale shows a highly structured society in which women play a very unusual role.
What's unusual about it? It's the role they mostly play.
Well, I want to explain that to me. Why do you see this as not unusual?
Well, they've gone back to the home. There's polygamy, which worldwide is more common than monogamy. And my handmaids in the tale are there for childbearing, as were the handmaids in the Bible. Genesis chapter 30, verses 1 to 13. So it's not something I dreamt up. It's concubines and women being relegated to simple childbearing and housekeeping has been with us for thousands of years.
Yes, but women in your society have no role to say in the governing of the nation. And this is something that has moved away from what women are now doing.
Yeah,
I mean, for the first time in the last five or 10 years, women are moving into major positions in government.
That's right,
politics.
But the last 5 or 10 years are the exception. This is not normal, what we have here in the society. This is new. This is unusual. It's this society here that's unusual. The society I describe in The Handmaid's Tale is back to basics.
Do you see us going back to basics?
I hope not. But I see certain movements in that direction, and I didn't put anything in the book that hasn't already happened sometime in history or isn't happening right now or for which we don't have the machinery. All the elements are there, and several things that I put in the book just as hypotheses, you know, postulations, logical extensions, have since happened.
You probably startled the readers of Bodily Harm by such a radical departure from the previous novel. Was this a difficult effort for you in making this change in approach?
Well, it was a big risk.
Yeah.
It was a big gamble. It could have been a total disaster. Any utopia or dystopia runs the danger of wandering off into descriptions of the sewage system, as you know. In your society, you used to dump all the sewage into the river, but now in this wonderful new society, we have the following sewage plant, which we will now take the reader on a very boring tour of. So there is that danger. Point of view had to be chosen very carefully and adhered to, which meant that I couldn't tell a lot of things in the body of the narrative because my character wouldn't have been able to know them. Her life is so restricted. That's one reason for having an historical note at the end. I'm answering questions in it that I, as a reader, would like to know the answers to.
Well, you took another chance, too, in that while I don't consider The Handmaid's Tale science fiction, the fact that you have set it in a different world in the future could lead somebody to say, well, that's just science fiction, and everybody knows science fiction is not well written. So just doing that alone is another
that was a risk.
Means of taking a chance.
That was a risk. There were a number of chancy things about it, which was probably why I put off writing it for several years after I got the idea. It seemed like a weird sort of book for me as a writer to be doing, and it seemed like a weird sort of book in general, but as time passed, it got less and less weird.
No, you pulled it off. There's no question about that. So where do you go from here? Are you going back to more conventional approaches?
Well, I have a couple of ideas, but I don't know which one of them I will try to follow up yet. I'll know that by about May or June when I'm finished all of this kind of thing, namely interviews and so forth, and get to shut myself up in my court-lined room again.
You're still writing poetry?
I, strangely enough, am. I'm still writing poetry.
And where are you living now?
Right now I am living in two cities at once. I'm living in New York, where I'm teaching at NYU. I'm something called the Berg Chair, and I'm teaching two courses. One is called Southern Ontario Gothic, and the
Southern
other...
Ontario
Southern
Gothic?
Southern Ontario Gothic. It's about people like Robertson Davies and Alice Munro. And the other one is a fiction workshop. I'm also living in Toronto where my family is, and I'm also on the road for Houghton Mifflin. So I'm traveling and camping out.
It sounds as though you have a very busy life, Margaret Atwood, and I'm delighted that you were able to stick me into your busy schedule, so to speak. And I did find the book fascinating. I found it very hard to put down. And I want to thank you very much for coming in and chatting with me. Thank Marley,
you.
Too, for dragging you in here.
Well, nice that you're still on the air.
Well, I am.
When my
week.
Group takes over, you won't be.
That's right. Well, listen, there are plenty of groups out there. Next week I may not be on the air.